of operator product expansion. It is a way of replacing the product of two operators. I'm not going to write all the glory details, but three. Well, this sum over three is over, over all operators, essentially, at x2. To essentially argue that any endpoint function of local operators in a CFT are determined in terms of data that is contained in the 2-point and 3-point functions. So the basic idea was that using the OPE, you can keep doing it so that you reduce everything to 2-point functions. That's one. But so that's where the 2-point function comes in. And the 3-point function is important because we showed that the coefficient that appears here in the operator product expansion is the tensor that appears in the 3-point function of three operators. So from here we get the OPE tensor. Okay. So in particular, if you look at the 4-point function of four identical scalar operators, which, as we discussed, is now not fixed anymore by conformal invariants. I mean, the conformal symmetry alone does not determine this function g of the cross ratio. Remember that u and b were the cross ratios. And there are two. There are two in any dimension for the 4-point. I replace one with three, so that's 1, 4. Two, three. Three square, x four square. And then there was some normalization factor. Okay. So we looked at this guy. This was not fixed by kinematics alone, so you have to use dynamics. And what does dynamics mean in this context? Is that the actual dynamics is given by what your theory is. What's your theory? Well, you have to tell me the data. You have to tell me the collection of all operators. And from these operators, what we need in particular is the dimensions. Also a spin, of course, but I'm not going to write that because you're familiar already with from the fact that you also have to know the spins of your operators. So that's part of the dynamics of the specifying dynamics of the theory, is telling you what your operators in the theory are. And the other part of the dynamics is that you have to tell me the 3-point functions. Okay, and then we determine this. By doing the OPE, so for example, one way in which we represented that is that you can compute the 4-point function by doing the OPE of one with two and three with four, and we represented this by this diagram, which means that you collide one and two, you do a OPE expansion of one and two, OPE expansion of three and four, and then you sum here over all intermediate states O. Okay, and that gives you a representation of this function GUV in terms of the data of the CFT. So the 3-point functions between O, 1 and 2, and O, 3 and 4, and the sum of everyone in your theory. So you will have to sum over all these guys, okay? So this allows you to solve the four-point function in terms of the two-point function, essentially, and the OPE data. But then we noticed that there is nothing special about this OPE channel. We could have computed the four-point function in a different channel by colliding 1 and 4 and 2 with 3. And again, you would, now the answer would look in a different representation. Here the answer would be represented. So if we conformally map the four points to 0, z, remember this was a coordinate in the complex plane. We could always map the fourth point to lie on a plane. So let's call z the coordinate in the complex plane. This would be at 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, and at infinity. Okay. So in this representation of the correlator, we're taking a series expansion of z around 0. Okay. So this gives you a representation of the answer as a power series, if you wish, in z. Okay. So that's one representation of the answer. Another representation of the answer is now that where you collide 2 with 3, so now you have a power series expansion around 1 minus z. Okay. So this crazy infinite series has to equal this other series, but one is expanded, is a series expansion around z equals 0, and the other one is an expansion around z equals 1. Okay. But the fact that these two series have a common domain of convergence implied that these two things have to be the same. Actually, a priori, you didn't know that they had to be the same. You could have two series that don't have a common, don't represent the same function in the same domain. But here, because of the convergence of the OPE, there is a common domain. And these two are equal. And from this, so that implied that the data that appears in this decomposition, which was these infinite sums of conformal blocks that involve the three-point functions and the sum over all the spectrum of the data, satisfy, must obey nonlinear constraints. So if you wish, you can use the four-point function to determine what constraints the CFT data has to obey. Okay. And the space of solution to these constraints is sparse. Okay, it's very sparse, which fits with the physics intuition that when you have a CFT, in order to get to a CFT, you have to tune parameters. Okay. Very good. Notice one, and in principle, this set of equations, these are complicated equations, especially in higher than two dimensions. These equations essentially fully determine the CFT, all the correlation functions of the CFT. Okay. Notice that this is quite remarkable. That this is very much at odds with what you've done so far. Usually in field theory, you start with a Lagrangian. And you do some correlation functions, and you determine it by doing some Feynman diagram expansion. Maybe something that you may have seen in your courses that one way you can get a CFT is that you start with some Lagrangian, and you perturb by a relevant operator. That RG flow can be weakly coupled in some cases, like in the epsilon expansion. Have the words epsilon expansion heard before or not? 4 minus epsilon expansion? No? You should have heard that, but okay. So there are ways of constructing in a reliable perturbative regime fixed points, conformal field theories, where you start with some CFT, one. So free, actually, the typical example is you start with a free field theory. You perturb now some relevant operator. So the theory is no longer conformal. But this triggers some RG flow to another CFT if you go to arbitrary large distance. So this will flow to some other CFT too, okay? Now, of course, CFT one, which was the original one, we know everything about it, so we know how to compute all the correlation functions. But this theory, we don't know how to compute anything a priori. So what people for example, did in the cases in which the CFT2 can be reached by in a perturbative regime is to essentially use perturbation theory here to extract information here. Okay. That, or you can define the CFT as, you can give the official definition of the CFT is say, okay, it's the endpoint of the RG flow of this CFT deformed by this relevant operator. Here we take a more pragmatic point of view. We don't, and the other thing that's important that you know from statistical mechanics is that the notion of universality, as a certain scaling behavior can arise from many different short distance models. So, you know, the critical exponents of water and whatever, some other things, magnets are the same because the critical behavior is governed by symmetries, essentially. Okay. So this point of view that we've been taking here, the point of view is that where we focus directly on this abstract object, the CFT2, and we don't care how you reach it from. If you reach it from water or a magnet or from the phi to the four Lagrangian or whatever. Okay? And we study just intrinsic consistency conditions of the CFT. Okay? This is very powerful because most CFTs of this type, in any case, you would not be able to study them reliably from an RG flow because since the operator here is relevant, the theory becomes strongly coupled in the infrared. So you wouldn't know what to do. Okay? So this point of view bypasses all of that and replaces that problem to the problem of solving those nonlinear constraints, okay? Which is a hard problem, of course, but it's very satisfactory. So in particular, in two dimensions, so there are special things that happen in two dimensions, and you will see a lot of that. In two dimensions, there is something very special that happens, that there are a special class of models that are called minimal models, and you will see this in future lectures, where the number of primary operators that exist, what are called minimal models, which play an important role in statistical mechanics, where you have a finite number have a finite number of primaries, where essentially all correlation functions are solutions of differential equations. So this is kind of a theorist's dream. Just by pure thought, you will find the answer to your problem but by solving a differential equation with some boundary condition. And these differential equations that you will study follow from studying the representation theory of the conformal algebra in 2+1 dimensions. But essentially, is studying this crossing equation. Oh, by the way, yeah. So this equation is called the crossing equation for obvious names because you cross 2 and 3. And this philosophy that the CFT determines its own consistency goes under the name of conformal bootstrap. Okay? The idea of this word is that the self-consistency of the theory tells you the solution of the theory. Okay? So you bootstrap your own shoes. Okay. Now, in higher dimensions, in particular D equals 3, where critical phenomena is very important, the number of primaries cannot be finite. And the way you can prove that is the following. Essentially, you can prove that by saying that the singularity structure of this function, say, around z equals 1, has to be reproduced by the left-hand side, right? That's what it means that you have OP data. And now you can just show that that a finite sum here over primaries could never reproduce that singularity, OK? So you need an infinite number of primaries.
So how is that solved in D equals 2?
Well, because you have first of all the conformal. Okay, so the conformal blocks in two dimensions are different types of bits than we've been discussing here. Actually, as we discussed, the conformal algebra is infinite dimensional, and the conformal blocks are just generically different.
Okay.
You will see more of that. Yeah. also the other thing that happens in two dimensions, things are split into holomorphic and anti-holomorphic things, which that doesn't happen in higher dimensions. That also plays an important role in bypassing this thing. You have an infinite number of primaries. So studying these equations is hard, but people in recent years have studied these equations numerically, and from here you can extract the critical exponents of models, again, that may have ultraviolet realization, and that play very important, relevant for nature. Also, CFT is relevant for nature. Like the Ising CFT, 3D Ising CFT. This is a lattice model that describes a critical phenomena near the critical point, relevant for nature. And from here, just by solving this equation, you can get this, not all of it, but the most relevant CFT data. So these are not only conceptually powerful equations, they are of practical importance to solve models that people were interested in. Before, it was always done in some ad hoc approximations. There are no approximations here. This is an exact, it's a theorism, it's an exact equation that you may or may not be able to solve. Okay. So that kind of completes at least logically the internal structure of CFTs. We have seen how the conformal symmetry constrained the correlators as much as possible, which was a lot. I mean, essentially it fixed the 2 and the 3 prime functions. And then we saw how the OPE essentially allowed you to conceptually solve any correlation function in terms of the previous ones. And we discovered that there is a set of equations that if you solve them, will give you the set of the data of the CFT, the dimensions and the couplings. Now you may ask, will I get? I mean, that's something maybe I can ask you to think about. So imagine now you could ask, what if I look at the 5-prime function? Could I not get more constraints by doing the 5-prime function in all different OPE channels? Okay. So one thing that you can convince you by drawing pictures is that endpoint functions for n bigger than 4 do not impose new constraints. By that I mean is that you can reduce the constraints of the higher point functions are automatically obeyed if the constraint from the 4-prime function crossing equation is obeyed. Okay. So you only have for the consistency of the, I mean, if you're interested in an experiment about the 5-prime function of a spin here and spin there, you will have to compute it. But conceptually, if you're trying to understand what is the data of the CFT and what are the constraints, there will be no more constraints beyond the 4-prime function. And the way you can prove it is just draw pictures and see that if you try to compute the 5-prime function in any channel, by channel I mean a choice of pairs of things that you collide, then you can look at the subgraph that if the 4-prime function of 4 operators is obeyed, will automatically imply the 5th one. Okay, say. So that's again very powerful. So, but this is a bit of a. So now you could ask, okay. So now you could ask, and this is kind of closer to the forefront of research. You could ask whether by studying the theory on some other manifold, whether I could get further constraints other than the discrossing equation. So the fair answer is that we don't really know. But it's believed that the answer is no in higher dimensions. But we know that actually that's the case in 2 dimensions, and you will study this. In 2 dimensions, so you have a 2-dimensional conformal field theory, and you don't study it in the plane, but you study it on the torus. A torus is a donut. Then there are further constraints that you get by demanding that the theory on the torus makes sense, essentially. And that's called modular invariance, that you will discuss it later. But for higher dimensional CFTs, it's believed that all constraints on the CFT data arise from the 4-prime. Okay. Good. So that's, I guess, as much as I wanted to say about this. conceptually. Now, another thing I want to discuss, because it connects with many, many things and goes well beyond the subject of CFTs, is the subject of anomalies. And of course, more specifically, we'll discuss conformal anomalies. So let's start from building things up. Okay, so what are we trying to do here? So so let's start from the notion of a classical symmetry, classical continuous symmetry. The existence of a classical continuous symmetry implies, essentially by Noether's theorem, the existence of a conserved current. Okay, that's the basic statement about classical symmetries and conservation laws. And this vanishes, so the current is conserved on shell. Okay, if you use the equations of motion of your theory, the classical equations of motion. Now, the existence of a conserved current defines a charge operator which essentially, in canonical quantization, is usually written as the integral of the zeroth component of the current over space. Okay, and this guy is a conserved charge. In particular, dq dt vanishes. A more abstract notion that is useful, but let me just mention it, is that a charge operator is associated, so this is an integral, over what's a codimension one surface in spacetime. I'm not integrating over the current over all spacetime. I'm integrating over one dimension less. That's called codimension one. Okay. So a charge operator is associated with some surface, sigma. So this operator O, if you wish, is defined by a surface sigma of codimension one. Okay, and the fact, and this follows from integrating by parts, so you can, I'll just say the word and you can show it very easily. One very remarkable property of this operator is that even though naively it depends on the choice of a surface, right? I have a surface here. The fact that the current is conserved implies that actually if I make a small wiggle on the surface, so imagine I have a correlation function of this gadget with a whole bunch of local operators. Okay. If I make a small deformation of the surface, the correlation function doesn't change. Okay. The statement is that by virtue of the conservation law, essentially the way you prove it is that you make a small deformation, you can write this as an integral over a closed surface of d mu j mu. So you have a charge operator of codimension one, which is topological. In the sense that it doesn't change by small perturbations. It will change if there's an operator here, okay, O of X, and I deform the surface in such a way that I go through the location of the operator. Now, can someone guess what the change of the correlator where this is the surface and this is the surface will be? I mean, what does the charge operator do to operators, to charged operators? It tells you the charge, right? So the difference between this guy and this guy will be by the charge of this operator. Okay. So if you have a Z2 charge, and for example, this guy has is odd under Z2, you will get a minus sign. Okay. Okay, so this is all a theorem about classical symmetry. But now we're trying to do quantization, right? So we're trying to quantize. So one question that you have to ask is whether this conservation law is preserved quantum mechanically. It could be, and it happens, that there is an irreducible obstruction to the conservation law by quantum effects. There is no way of quantizing the theory while preserving a given symmetry. Okay? And that's exactly what an anomaly is. An anomaly essentially is a violation of a classical symmetry. So now this thing from zero and of order h bar is a violation of a classical symmetry to your quantum effects. Okay? Good.
I'm sorry, I got a bit lost.
Yes.
So are the conservation of that charge, so the conservation of the charge would be of a non-anomalous thing if the mu j mu is not equal to zero?
No worries. So this discussion was about in the classical theory.
But the topology, the part of the of Q of sigma being topological is quantum, right? Because we're talking about topological in expectation values when I don't cross any other
operation. Yes, so the thing that we'll have to worry about is that this statement I told you about the charge is a statement if the theory was not anomalous. If the theory is anomalous, there might be a correction to the contribution to the theory in this way and this way. And that's called the anomaly.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
So this obstruction is like a topological obstruction, or?
The word topological is usually associated to anomalies. So yes, in a certain sense it's topological. The obstruction is measured by a certain topological term, okay? Which means by something that does not depend on the geometry of spacetime. And actually the fact that the anomalies are topological, okay, so now I'll make a little digression. So the fact that the anomalies are topological in a very concrete sense, that actually is what makes them extremely powerful. So usually we associate the word anomaly to something that's awful, right? I mean, so an anomaly, you don't want to have anomalies, right? But actually anomalies in this context are extremely powerful. Why? So the first statement is that anomalies are topological. So let me just say this slogan. And you will say concretely in the case of the conformal anomaly, in what sense they are topological. So anomalies are topological. Which in particular means they're independent of length scale. Topology doesn't know about distances, right? So why is this powerful? Actually, it's powerful roughly in this. So remember that at some point I discussed that you start with some theory in the ultraviolet and you deform it, or this is already the deformed theory, and it flows in the infrared to some QFT in the infrared. Okay. Now, a priori, you don't know anything about this RG flow because this theory is infinitely strongly coupled and you don't know what you're talking about, essentially. Now, and that's what anomalies are, essentially one of our very few, if not only, lampposts that can give you some information about the properties that this theory has to obey. Okay. Why do I say that? Because imagine you start with this theory and you know how to compute this theory in the ultraviolet, like QCD. You know how to compute with it, you know how to do Feynman diagrams, and you discover that this theory has an anomaly of this type. Okay? The anomaly. Now, what you know immediately from the fact that the anomaly is topological is that the anomaly cannot disappear at any length scale. You have an anomaly at one proton length scale. That anomaly has to be there at Hubble scale. Okay? So that means that if this theory has an anomaly here, this anomaly has to be present in the infrared theory. So that means that imagine you're very clever, you are, and you say, okay. It wasn't meant to be a joke, but it was funny. Okay, so actually one of the things that this may not be apparent yet, but it will be apparent later, is that actually in physics, most of the times we do guesswork, a lot of guesswork, and then you try to prove things. So imagine you start with a theory that you care about, like QCD, and you want to understand what happens to QCD at long distances, okay? And now you say, okay, I have no idea, I cannot use Feynman diagrams, what am I going to do? So one of the things that we tend to do in physics is to say, okay, let me try to guess what is the low energy description of QCD, okay? And you can have a proposal and I can have a different proposal. One thing that this proposal has to obey or it's wrong, it doesn't matter how clever you are, is that the anomalies of the theory that you propose in the infrared
have to match the anomalies in the ultraviolet. If they don't match, I don't care, it's wrong, okay? Now, if they match, it doesn't prove that it's right, because you've only checked one. No, it is usually, they're still very non-trivial concept, but you only have checked that, you have checked that the proposal at least is viable, okay? So that's why anomalies are very powerful, because if you have a system that has an anomaly in the ultraviolet, and that, and you want to understand its strongly coupled infrared dynamics, you can use the fact that the theory has these anomalies to constrain what can appear in the infrared. If the theory, for example, let me give you a very trivial example, okay, that will make it obvious. So imagine the theory has an anomaly in the ultraviolet. Now you could ask whether the theory in the infrared, remember in the early in the course I said that you have a trivial theory in the infrared, essentially an empty theory, you could have just nothing left, okay? Well, you immediately know that this cannot happen if this theory has an anomaly, because the trivial theory cannot have anomaly, it has nothing in it, okay? So it tells you, for example, that this theory cannot flow through a trivial theory. It has to flow to something interesting. It could either be a CFT or it could be a topological field theory, okay? So this is the kind of power that anomalies gives us. And that, I mean, that's why I'm telling you about them, okay? But yeah, so going back to your question, so anomalies are topological, and the fact that they're topological is that's why we care a lot about them, okay? Good. Okay, now there are violations of I use the word anomaly in a very specific context in which the thing that appears in the right-hand side here is, so on the right-hand side, what you have to write down is an operator, right? This is an operator equation. So we're gonna discuss the anomalies that where this is powerful is where this guy is an expression that will depend on various things that you will see in a moment, times the identity operator. Okay. There are other violations of classical symmetries where, and we discussed some of them. For example, you can have violations in which here on the right-hand side you get some operator O that's non-trivial. Okay. So I don't personally call these things anomalies because this just tells you that the symmetry is just broken, explicitly broken in a very hard way. Okay. Now, here also the symmetry is broken, but in a very mild way that we will see in a moment. This, if the violation of the conservation law is proportional to the identity operator, essentially, if you look at all correlation functions of the theory, the correlation functions obey the word identities or the symmetry constraints of that symmetry, except if you collide points. If the two points are at the same point, if the two points are brought together, then there is a violation. While here it's just a violation everywhere, it's a disaster, okay? And those are not, I mean, they're important, but they're not the ones I'm talking about, okay? Sometimes the word, so these kind of anomalies, they're usually referred to as Stuft anomalies by the person that understood many aspects of this thing, okay? Okay, so now that of course, this is an extremely rich subject, and I could expand actually a whole 3 weeks of lectures on them, but I don't have time for that. So, and there are several points of view. I will try to comment on two points of view on anomalies that are, I think, are useful. Well, at least one of them I hope to get to. One of them is like very down to earth and very easy to understand, very conceptually clean. So I'll start with that one. The other one is more powerful in the sense that you can immediately generalize it to any anomaly. But this one is conceptually simpler. One small comment I should make is that, okay, so that's also important to say maybe. There are a lot of parentheses today. One thing that's important to say is that in when we talk in physics about symmetries, even though it's a misnomer, we usually mean two things. You have heard the word of a global symmetry. Okay, that's a standard thing. So global symmetries are things, are symmetries under which the Hilbert space form representations. So states in the Hilbert space form representations of that symmetry. But then you also have heard of the word gauge symmetry, right? Well, this is an awful name because it's not a symmetry. And how do you know it's not a symmetry? Because in the Hilbert space, by definition, you have to impose Gauss's law, right? When you have a gauge theory, you have to impose the analog of Gauss's law. And what is the statement of Gauss's law? Is that all the states in the Hilbert space are gauge invariant, are singlets, okay? So they don't transform at all under the gauge symmetry. So one thing about anomalies is the following. anomalies for a gauge symmetry are a disaster. Why? Because what do we use gauge symmetry? I'm going to use the language, even though it's not correct. What do we use gauge symmetries for? We use it to eliminate negative norm states, right? So if you study Maxwell's equation, A0, the zero component of the gauge field, has a negative norm, okay? But in Poisson-Gaussian's law, projects out that state from the Hilbert space, okay? But now if the theory is anomalous, you cannot use that symmetry anymore to project it out, so the theory ceases to be unitary, okay? So anomalies in a gauge symmetry means the death of the theory. It's inconsistent with quantum mechanics. While a violation, an anomaly in a global symmetry is actually quite wonderful because it allows you to, you know, do these constraints of RC flows. And notice that if you look at the standard model for particle physics, I mean the standard model, so it has a certain gauge symmetries, right? It has you must have a reverse U3 times U2 times U1. Now you can ask, are those symmetries anomaly free or anomalous? Okay. Well, of course they're anomaly free, but it's quite amazing how the standard model is kind of at the verge of dying, and the anomalies cancel. So if you look at only at the leptons or the quarks, the theory is anomalous. But only after you sum over the whole set of particles in the standard model that anomalies, there's a kind of cancellation between the contribution of the anomaly, say, of the quarks and the leptons. Okay. So in the standard model, it's kind of miraculously avoids being consistent by the precise nature of the particles that live in the standard model. Okay. End of parentheses. Okay, so now we're going to discuss anomalies in the context of this course, which is the conformal anomaly.
Quickly differentiate between ABJ anomalies and Tift
anomalies. This is a matter of nomenclature. Depends what you mean by different people mean different things by ABJ anomaly.
Well, the standard model that you mentioned is ABJ.
Yes. So Tuft anomaly, but for me, it's always an anomaly for a global symmetry.
Okay.
More specifically, what I mean by a Tuft anomaly is that you have a global symmetry. Whenever you have a global symmetry, you can couple a global symmetry to a background gauge field. That's not dynamical. Okay, so another thing. Whenever you have a conserved current J mu, you can couple to a background gauge field. Okay, we'll do that in a second. Background gauge field means what? That's, it's an experimentalist that has electric and magnetic field and he or she freezes it and that's it, okay? This is to be contrasted with the gauge fields in the standard model, right? The gauge fields in the standard model, you path integrate over them. They're dynamical, okay? So by Tuft anomalies, I mean are violations of the conservation law when you couple the system to a background gauge field for that symmetry, okay? But in a sense, the ABJ anomaly, so the point of view I like to take on anomaly is that you shouldn't, you look at the global symmetries and then you can decide to gauge them or not gauge them. Like in the standard model, we gauge SU3 times SU times U1. But so you do this first step, and now later on you decide, oh, but I want to gauge that symmetry because I want SU3 color to be gauged. Then you know, okay, you're dead. But there is no conceptual real difference between ABJ and Tuft anomaly. It's a matter of whether you're going to gauge that symmetry or not.
Okay.
So now let's discuss the conformal anomaly. In two dimensions, it can be done in higher dimensions. Actually, the other point of view that I may not have time to discuss will show you that conformal anomalies can only exist in even number of dimensions. Okay, so let's remember that conformal invariance, this is something we proved earlier in the course, implies that the trace of the energy momentum tensor vanishes, right? That you can always improve the energy momentum tensor so that it vanishes. This is the analog of this equation. Is that clear? One way of saying this is that the current associated to conformal transformations parametrized by a conformal Killing vector, zeta, right? This is a conformal Killing vector, is T mu nu zeta nu. Okay? Good. Now, so let's now study the following object, the two-point function in momentum space of the energy momentum tensor. And now again, this part of the first this part of the discussion is something that very related to what we've done so far, which is to constrain the correlator just using symmetries, okay? And then we'll impose more structure. So now, how would you solve this problem? So we know that Lorentz invariance tells you that the energy momentum tensor is symmetric in the indices, okay? So now what you have to do is, things have to make sense. So you have to write down on the right-hand side all possible things that you can write down given which data. So can someone tell me what can appear on the right-hand side here? Sorry? You said something. It's probably correct what you said.
Big tensor with...
Sorry, which?
The big tensor with...
Big tensor. No, but okay. So what is the tensor made out of? What is the data here? We're in flat space.
You have Minkowski and the P.
We have Minkowski metric and the P, okay? So you have to write down the most general thing using the Minkowski metric. So the data is eta mu nu and P mu, such that it has the same symmetry property. Okay, the indices match, that's okay, minus one law. The one law is that it has the symmetries of the left-hand side, so it's symmetric in mu and nu and P and nu, okay? It turns out there are five different ways of combining P and mu, eta and P to do that. Can someone give me just one example of thing that can appear on the right-hand side?
Eta mu nu P rho P sigma?
Yes, that's an example, yes. So I'm not sure I will write all of them because... And now a function of P square. This is analog of, this is a Lorentz invariant, right? P square is Lorentz invariant, so, okay. But then can be another one, so it can be, there can be also a term P mu, P nu, P rho, P sigma. That's also allowed, right? By the laws of nature. It transforms, blah, 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 properly. And actually there are five of them. So there are five in total, five possibilities, okay? Essentially, the way you should think about it is that you should look at terms of have order zero in P, order P square in P, and order P to the fourth in P. You cannot put more than P because you run out of indices, essentially, okay? Or, the indices will have to be contracted so that you get P square, a Lorentz scalar, okay? So I think it would be a good exercise in a slightly different context, to understand how to use symmetry to constrain correlators, to write down what are the five most general tensors you can write down that have the symmetries of the left-hand side. Now we're going to impose the fact that our theory is translational, is translationally invariant. What does this mean in terms of this correlator? So what constraints should this correlator obey if the theory is translationally invariant? Yes?
If we contract with one of the P's?
Yes, exactly. So translational invariance implies that P mu, T mu nu has to vanish, right? That's the conservation law for translations, right? So now I do that here, and now I have to look at the P mu of this thing has to vanish. Well, doing this exercise imposes three relations, okay? So it imposes three relations among the five structures. So here there are five possibilities. That means that there are five functions. If you use F1, F2, blah, 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 okay? So all I've done is impose conservation laws, okay? Good. Now, it is convenient to organize the two structures left in the following way. So you know from general relativity and problem from quantum field theory that there is a nice tensor that you can construct that is manifestly traceless, not traceless, divergence-less, okay? So you can define the tensor P mu, which is P mu, P nu, minus eta mu nu P square, okay? And it has the property that obviously P mu pi mu nu equals zero, okay? So since I told you that the right-hand side has to be conserved, if I act with any P here, okay, any P on any of these four indices, you have to have something that's automatically conserved. So that means that the right-hand side has to be able to be written in terms of these pi mu nus that have automatically are automatically conserved. Okay. Good. So let me go there.
I'm sorry. I got a bit lost with the arguments. They're in the t's inside that expectation value. Why is t mu nu of p?
Sorry.
What do you mean by t mu nu of p? Like.
Okay. T mu nu is usually you think of it as a local operator, right? It's a function of x, right? But I can do the Fourier transform. It's just a Fourier transform of.
Okay.
So t mu nu of p.
Sorry.
Is dx. E to the IPX, t mu nu of x. Why is this guy at p and minus p? I use a momentum conservation.
Okay.
This is the momentum space version of saying that things depend on x1 minus x2. The total momentum has to vanish. Yes?
Then we take the expected value over p then?
No, p is an external thing. I don't know, I mean, p is not an operator. It's like when you have, yeah.
Yeah, it's the expectation value on, it's not a correlation between p and minus p. It's not the same bracket as the one we had before, which is my question.
No, it is. It is the expectation value, but over the fields, right?
Yes, over the fields, yes. Another way of saying that this is the momentum space, is a Fourier transform to momentum space of the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor, where this guy is at x1 and this guy is at x2. Am I not saying this clearly?
Okay.
You can just, if you have a correlator in position space, you can Fourier transform to momentum space and vice versa. So I'm just writing it for convenience and you will see why in momentum space. No, something is bothering you. You should say, because if it bothers you, it will bother someone else. I can try to.
It's just because before we use spatial correlation functions, and now we
yeah, but they're related by if you know the correlation function in position space, you know them in momentum space and vice versa. They're related by a Fourier transform. So imagine the two-point function. The one point goes like x. The two-point function went like this, right?
Yeah.
How would I find OP? Okay, would you want O minus P? I would do the Fourier transform of this function. That's it. I mean, if you knew this answer, you know this answer. Vice versa, Fourier transform. P here is no different than X here. You don't take the average of X, right? I mean, X is some experimental is input data. So P is also an experimental, you throw some energy momentum tensor with some momentum and that's it. This bracket means that you path integrate over your CFT fields, if you wish, even though we're not talking really in that language. Yeah. Is that clear now, a clear error? Yeah, okay. So I said that we impose conservation laws. And now we can write the most general two-point function in terms of two structures that I'm going to separate in terms of the Lorentz interpretation. Okay, so it's going to be t mu nu p, t rho sigma, both the momentum minus p, the two-point function is going to be, why do I do it this way? So remember, the right-hand side, I should be able to write in terms of this pi because the right-hand side has to automatically be conserved in all indices. So I should be able to build it out of pi's. But it has to have the symmetries of the left-hand side. So you can show in this simple way, pi nu rho minus 2 over d minus 1 p mu nu p rho sigma. This is a function of p squared. That's just a Lorentz scalar, plus pi mu nu power rho sigma some function of P squared here. Okay. Now, what's the interpretation of this? The interpretation is that this structure corresponds to what you could call a spin 2 exchange, and this would be a spin 0 exchange. Okay. The point is that this guy, why do I call it a spin 0, I mean a spin 2? This guy is traceless. If you take the trace of this, it vanishes. Okay. Good. So now let's go to two dimensions. Now, something special happens in two dimensions. Okay, all this so far was in general space and dimensions. Let's go to d equals 2. Since I'm running a bit late, I'll ask you to prove the following thing. In two dimensions, this guy actually vanishes. Exactly, you only have one term. One way you can prove that is the following. You can prove that pi mu nu can be written as p tilde nu, where p tilde mu is epsilon mu nu p nu, okay? And now if you compute the square of that, you have two epsilons. And two epsilons can be decomposed into, this is actually the formula for the determinant, okay? And you get exactly these two terms. Well, the terms I have here, okay? So if you write it this way, all these terms are exactly the same thing. It's a product of p tilde mu rho sigma lambda, right? A product of the p's with p tildes with each one of these indices, right? The same here, but this cancels it because for d equals 2, I get minus 2 times the same thing. Okay, so this guy is not there. So in two dimensions, we only have to worry about this, okay? And this guy can be written. What are we going to do? Okay, now, so far this was for a general Lorentz invariant, Poincaré invariant theory. Now let's look at a scale invariant theory. In a scale invariant theory, the only dimensionful things are essentially the only scale that we have available is the dimensionful quantity is the momentum. Okay. Essentially, what are we after? We're after this function g of p squared. Now, in a scale invariant theory, g of p squared is fixed by dimensional analysis. Can someone tell me what this function, this g has to be? For the dimensions on the left match the dimensions on the right? This is slightly tricky, so if you don't, okay, you can try. Okay, so let's break it up. What is the dimension of the energy momentum tensor in momentum space? The Fourier transform of the energy momentum tensor. Okay, what is the dimension of the energy momentum tensor in position space? Think of the definition in terms of the variation of the action. Is the variation with respect to the metric, right? The metric is dimensionless. So you have to soak up the dimension of space-time. So the dimension of t mu nu of x is d, the space-time dimension, right? The Fourier transform has an integral over d dx, so it means that the dimension of this guy is 0. Because I'm doing the Fourier transform of this, which has dx integrals, right? So the left-hand side has dimension 0. Now, this guy has dimension 2 and dimension 2, right? That p mu nu is essentially this thing, right? Now, one thing I didn't really say is that here you should think of the delta function. It should be a delta function of momentum, if you wish, that I've already imposed, okay? What is the dimension of a delta function? There's this funny thing that the dimension of delta function is 1 over the dimension of the thing that you had, okay? So it has dimension minus 2. So you have...
No, it has dimension 2.
It has dimension 2, but p has dimension... Yeah. There is a p here, so...
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
So you have 2 plus 2 minus 2 is 2, okay? But the left-hand side had dimension 0, so this has to be 1 over p squared. times a coefficient C that's dimensionless that we don't know about. Okay. So that's the most general form of the two-point function of an energy momentum tensor in a scale invariant theory, okay, in two dimensions. In higher dimensions, you would have to worry about this term, but let's worry about the two dimensions. Okay. Good. Now, and this is the most general expression. So far, I've allowed everything that's allowed. Okay. Now you can ask: is the trace of the energy momentum tensor vanished or not? So let's compute it. I have made no choices here. This is the most general thing. Okay. So this. I'm using, you know, Lorentz invariants, scale invariants, all, you know, fundamental properties. Okay, so now I take the trace of the energy momentum tensor. What do I get here? The trace of pi mu nu. Okay, remember that pi mu nu is pi mu p nu minus eta mu nu p squared, right? So if I look at eta mu nu p mu nu, this is proportional to p squared, right? Is that clear? So that means that when I take the trace here, I cancel this 1 over p squared, okay? But I get something non-zero. I get up to some coefficient I'm not caring about. It's proportional to c times pi rho sigma, okay? So now you would say, oh, this is a problem. What just happened here? Imagine I was in a conformal field theory. In a conformal field theory, the trace of the energy momentum tensor should vanish, right? But I just showed you that in a arbitrary CFT, but I didn't specify what CFT it was. From looking at the most general form of the two-point function, we discovered that the correlation function of the trace of the energy momentum tensor is non-zero. So you say this is a catastrophe. So so this implies an anomaly. Okay. So, but now let's study in more detail. Because it means that T mu mu is distinct from zero in correlation functions. But now let's see, what we will now discuss a bit is that the violation of conformal symmetry is of a very specific type. The best way to see that is actually now to go to position space. I want to see how badly is the conformal symmetry violated. No, so now let's Fourier transform this position space. Okay, so what is P rho sigma? Pi rho sigma. Pi rho sigma is a polynomial in momentum, right? It's a quadratic polynomial in momentum. Now, what is the Fourier transform of a polynomial in momentum, two position space?
I mean, if one thought of it as acting on something, it would be derivatives, right?
But it's acting on something, what? What is the Fourier transform of one?
The delta?
Yeah. So you get derivatives of the delta function. So here, what you're going to get is C times d nu minus eta mu nu delta square acting on delta 2 of x. And that's just the Fourier transform of any polynomial of momentum, the Fourier transforms to derivatives of the delta function. Okay. Okay, so now let's make a few comments about this. The first comment to make is that if the two operators are at separated points, so that the two operators are not touching each other, the right-hand side vanishes, right? So it means that the violation, this anomaly is a very specific type. It's not a horrible violation where all correlation functions do not obey the conformal word identities. It means that it says that the violation only happens when this guy is exactly on top of this guy. So this is a very mild violation of conformal symmetry. It's just violated at one point, okay? Now you could say, oh, well, why don't I cancel the anomaly? Let me just, why can I choose C equals zero? Well, that would be inconsistent with unitarity. Why would it be inconsistent with unitarity? Because if C is zero, it means that the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor at separated points, because this could be any point, would be zero, and that doesn't make any sense, okay? Okay. The energy momentum tensor is a non-trivial operator. It cannot be that it's zero, okay? So that means that this this is an irreducible. I mean, this is a prime example of an anomaly. It's called a conformal anomaly. It's an irreducible violation of conformal invariance, which in the language of currents is the statement that the trace of the energy momentum tensor no longer vanishes. Okay. Now let's use a slightly different, more geometrical point of view on anomalies that will connect with topology in a second. Now let's do exactly what I said here, somewhere here, that you can couple the current to a background gauge field for that symmetry. So what is the thing that couples to the energy momentum tensor? Is the graviton, right? So now we can consider coupling our flat space CFT. We're in flat space here. Let's couple our flat space CFT to a metric, okay? And now let me study in position space. Okay, so let me study the trace of the energy momentum tensor coupled to a theory where I deformed the theory. I deformed the theory. So eta goes to eta plus h. Okay, what does this mean in down-to-earth language? It means that I have added to my action, if you wish, the term h mu nu, t mu nu, right? That's what coupling the theory to a background metric means, is you couple the energy momentum tensor to the metric, okay? So now what I'm doing is I'm doing a small perturbation. So if I'm an experimentalist, how do I add a perturbation theory? I could bring a black hole in, that's hard, but you can bring a very massive object. It will change the metric in space-time a little bit. And I want to see now how the anomaly that we measured in flat space corresponds to when I couple it to background metric. So how would you compute this in perturbation theory in the graviton? You would just keep bringing down powers of h, right? That's how you do perturbation theory. To first order, to zeroth order, you would get zero, right? Because you would only have, okay, so what you do is you expand in h, and you compute the correlator of the energy momentum tensors that you get in flat space, okay? But we know that the energy momentum tensor, the one point function of the energy momentum tensor in flat space has to vanish just by conformal symmetry. That's what, the, you know, so we said the one point function vanishes and lets it's the identity operator. So the first contribution comes from bringing down one power of this guy. So from here, I'm gonna get dx, t mu mu at zero, t rho sigma at x, h rho sigma at x. Is it clear what I did here? I just brought down the exponential, okay? Yes.
The perturbation we do in the metric of the space-time,
yes,
to preserve conformal invariance too, right? Or?
No. No.
We don't care
about this. No. Okay. No. It's like when you turn on a background gauge field for U1 symmetry, the gauge field doesn't have to respect the U1 symmetry. But the more precise way of saying it is that the metric, if I do an arbitrary diffeomorphism, it will not lift it invariant. But if I do a conformal Killing transformation, this term is invariant because T mu mu is conserved for a conformal Killing vector. Remember that we discussed how these horrible things that T mu mu has to equal a second derivative of blah, blah, blah. That came precisely from demanding that this term was invariant. You wish that the variation was invariant. The variation of this tells you the conservation laws of T mu mu under conformal Killing vector, essentially. Okay, so now I can use this formula, right? So essentially what I want to show you is that the violation of the trace of the energy momentum tensor was a contact term. Contact term means that it only happens at one point. Once you couple the system to a background metric or a background gauge field for that symmetry, it becomes a violation at finite at all points. Okay? And this is true of all anomalies, okay? But let's see it more explicitly here. So now what I can do is I can replace this by this thing here, right? Now, what can I do to proceed? I'm not copying it again. This thing would be here, right? Exactly this thing. So roughly here you would have dd minus eta squared delta, right? Now I can integrate by parts and do the integral. I can move all these derivatives acting on h, and then I can just trivially do the integral over x, right? So I integrate by parts. And then I integrate over x. So I'm, okay, so I'm gonna get d mu, so d rho, d sigma minus eta rho sigma, delta square with a c here, acting on h rho sigma of x. So what did I show? I showed that in a theory that has a conformal anomaly, so that c is not zero, which is it has to be for any unitary theory. The trace of energy momentum tensor, when I couple it to background metric, is really non-zero everywhere, right? Because this is zero everywhere, okay? But it's proportional to the identity operator. Notice that what appears here on the right-hand side is background fields. These are not operators in the theory, okay? Good.
How would you get an operator? I mean, under correlation functions, you would never expect on the right-hand side an operator.
No, for example, take Young-Mills theory. Uh-huh. We know that classically T mu mu is zero, right? But at one loop, you get that T mu mu is the beta function of G times F square, F mu square.
But with correlation, like without correlation functions or with correlation functions?
This is an operator. These kind of equations are called operator equations. They're true inside any correlation function.
Yeah, no, what I refer is that if you have, on the left-hand side, on the left-hand side, if you put an expectation value on the left-hand side, you have a number. On the right-hand side, you cannot expect.
No, but the way you think about it is that now I have here other things. I could have other operators in there, and that would be a local statement. It's like the OPE. The OPE is valid if there are other people around. The same thing is true. These kind of equations, like this equation, it would be valid if there are other operators anywhere else.
Okay,
so what we found is that once I couple the energy momentum tensor to the CFT to background metric, I get that the trace is non-vanishing. Now, can someone tell me what this thing is? Does it remind you of something that you've seen? You've seen it before, for sure. So, okay, so I'll give you some hints. So the theory is translational invariant, okay? So it means that once you couple to background metric, it means that it's diffeomorphism invariant. So whatever you write here on the right-hand side has to be diffeomorphism invariant. It has to be a scalar, then all integers are contracted. What is this thing? Sorry?
Those the Einstein equations for...
Well, the Einstein equation has funny indices in them, right? But it's close. This is the Ricci scalar. So this is the Ricci scalar linearized. Linearized Ricci scalar to first order in a fluctuation, right? So now, if you actually proceeded further and computed this to all orders in the metric, what you would find is that the trace of T mu mu is proportional to C times the Ricci scalar. Okay. And this is an example in, so that's a general statement. I only have proven this to you to leading order in a fluctuation of the metric around flat space, but you can keep it iterating to prove that. There is a more powerful point of view that I don't have time to talk about, which is closer to some notions in cohomology that allows you to directly see that what has to appear here is a curvature. But this one is kind of more from bottom-up point of view. Now, and this fits well with the notion that the anomaly is a topological invariant. You probably know that the Ricci scalar in two dimensions is a topological invariant. The integral of it gives you the Euler density of the surface. Okay? So the violation of conformal symmetry is governed by a topological term, which is the Euler density. Okay. Good. And I'll just finish making one comment. So okay. And Tufte anomalies will function pretty much in a similar way in all examples. Okay. At least Tuft anomalies for global symmetries. There's an interesting subject that actually is still kind of ongoing. What happens of Tuft anomalies for discrete symmetries? But let's not go there. And actually, I think in the homework you will be asked to derive the anomaly for things that are in a sense are you've already seen. Maybe you didn't see anomaly, but you will see that it was there even if you were not looking. You will discover that you will look at the anomaly, what's called the chiral anomaly. So you will have a U1 conserved current, and you will doing a very similar logic, just writing the most general thing, blah, 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 and looking conservation law. You will find that there is an irreducible violation of the conservation of the current. Okay. And actually, again, this violation has important consequences for the dynamics of the theory. Now, this quantity C is very important. Okay. So what is C? Do you want to go into that? Maybe not. Well, okay, so the C is known as the conformal anomaly. And remember that in CFTs, I told you that in the space of quantum field theories, we were looking for a quantity that, so we said that if you can start from a CFT in the ultraviolet, and you do an RG flow, you deform it, and you get a CFT in the infrared. We were looking for a quantity that was monotonic. That's exactly this quantity, okay, that DC function. Okay, I ran already over time. I think next time you will start with a systematic treatment of the two-dimensional CFT. Thank you.